How many of you like smorgasbords? Let me see your hands. Come on, come on. It's a great word, isn't it, smorgasbord? Not only do I like smorgasbords, but normally at the holidays, Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, we normally kind of have our own buffet at home. But I have a couple of problems with restaurants that feature smorgasbords. First of all, I always end up eating not the items that I really like, but the items that are the most expensive. I do that because anytime I go into a restaurant like that, I have this overwhelming feeling that my main goal is to get my money's worth. And so instead of eating a nice balanced diet, or even instead of eating the things that I really like, I end up eating steak and prime rib and, you know, crab legs, things like that. You know, so I'm getting my money's worth. And that leads to my second problem. You know, whether the buffet is at a restaurant or at home, I end up eating the calories that the USDA says ought to be spread over the next 3 days. You know, when I eat at Golden Corral, I wonder why the waiters don't have hand trucks so that they can wheel me out to my car, you know, when I'm done. The smorgasbord is a fitting symbol of our culture. We live in a country where we have all that we could possibly want and more. We live in a country where we have so much that we expect to be able to pick and choose from among many attractive offerings. We shop in grocery stores and in department stores that are all but smorgasbords, just in a different sense. And if we can't find it at Best Buy or Target, well, then even more is available by means of Amazon Prime. And this consumer culture, this smorgasbord sophistication, affects more than just our eating, more than just our shopping. It also affects our religion. Many people today approach religion in much the same way as they approach a smorgasbord. They pick and choose what they want to believe and practice and what they don't want to believe and practice. Now, perhaps the most visible proponent of this approach to religion has been Oprah Winfrey. Now, Oprah doesn't have her daily show anymore, but she is still arguably the most successful woman in television, and she still influences millions of people in our country. Some would say that Oprah has led a revival of spirituality in our land, and I would agree. But I would quickly add that it has been a revival of smorgasbord spirituality. Pick and choose what you want from Christianity and any other religion out there. Whatever strikes your fancy, pick and choose from among the spiritual snack bar. You don't like the idea of hell? Don't put it on your plate. You like the idea that God is love? You don't like the idea that God is a judge? Have it your way. Well, what if your idea of religion ends up being self-contradictory and illogical? Doesn't make any difference. No one has to explain himself at a smorgasbord. You can put a dill pickle on your ice cream if you want. Now, you may not know it, but we have an example of just this kind of smorgasbord spirituality in the pages of the Old Testament in a little-known story here in the book of Judges. Now, my bet is that you have never heard a sermon or even a Sunday school lesson on this passage. It doesn't focus on a judge, and so it never seems to figure into the Sunday school curriculum. And also, the story is a bit offbeat. It doesn't deal in neat categories. Now, there is a key to understanding this offbeat passage. We need to get into the author's head. In the two chapters that we're going to consider this morning, Judges 17 and 18, the author never mentions the name of God. Not even once. Several of the characters speak God's name, but God doesn't speak up. The author never mentions him. The divine author, it seems, wants to keep God as far away from this story as possible. Very subtly, without actually saying it out loud, he leads us to think the true and living God doesn't really have anything to do with these events. And then secondly, we need to realize that the author is using irony or outright sarcasm in these chapters. Now, it seems like he's reporting these events almost like a reporter. It's just as if we're reading the Jerusalem Times, dateline 2000 BC. But underneath the veneer of objectivity, there is an undercurrent of irony, of sarcasm. 10 years ago or so, I was asked to give a lecture to a class of ministerial students at Bob Jones. And the title of my lecture was How to Lose Your Pastorate in 30 Days. And I gave them 10 great ideas for losing their first pastorate. Now, obviously, my tongue was planted firmly in my cheek as I spoke to them. And I get the same idea when I read these two chapters. The author is not recommending the kind of spirituality that we see in this passage. Rather, by means of irony, by means of sarcasm, he is pointing out a supreme example of spiritual failure. The theme of the book of Judges is spiritual failure. And chapters 17 and 18 serve as a prime example of the kind of spiritual failure that characterized these days in Israel's history. So, with that background, we're going to jump into the story. Now, most of you know, normally when I preach a passage, I read the passage and then I preach an outline on that passage. Well, today that would mean reading two chapters to you and then preaching them. And so I'm not going to do that. And hopefully you got tipped off by the outline that's in your hands, because it's not an outline. So what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to read through Judges chapter 17 and 18 and make comments on this. This is a style of preaching called commenting. And if you don't like it, tough. I don't use it very often, but I think it's exactly what this passage calls for. And my comments will obviously come to a very sharp point by the end of the message. So let's begin reading in Judges 17 and verse 1. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it." Now no wonder she utters this curse. 1,100 pieces of silver was a fortune. It would take the average person 100 years to amass such a fortune if they spent nothing. By my calculations, it would be something on the order of $3 to $5 million in terms of our economy today. In any case, her son returned the fortune. And the end of verse 2 says, "And his mother said, 'May you be blessed by the Lord, my son.' So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now therefore I will return it to you. Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. Now we could start with the observation here, like mother, like son, or it takes a thief to raise a thief. You'll notice she said, I'm going to give you back the money, and what did she do? She took, you figured out. She took 200 of the 1,100 shekels. Rather, I really want to focus on the actions of Micah's mother here as she sidles up to the spiritual smorgasbord. We can start, first of all, with the observation that the missus seems to use blessing and cursing like magic. Magic in this sense is seeking to manipulate or control gods by means of words. And she didn't get that practice from the law of Moses. She would have gotten that practice from her Canaanite neighbors. So it might surprise us that upon the return of her fortune, she takes the self-contradictory step of seeking to honor the Lord. That's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Here in our New King James Version, when you see that title all in capitals, it is a translation of the word Yahweh, or what the old King James Version would have translated, Jehovah. This is the covenant name of the true and living God. So in selecting from the spiritual smorgasbord, first of all, she's cursing like a Canaanite, and the next thing she's doing is worshiping Yahweh. She's not worshiping Baal, she's not worshiping Asherim, she's worshiping the Lord. But notice how she intends to honor and worship the covenant God of Israel. She takes 200 shekels of silver and commissions a carved image and a molded image. Now, we're not sure if that's talking about two idols or one, but that's really beside the point. Because what is important is that the law of Moses uses these very words to prohibit this kind of idolatry. Keep your finger here in Judges 17 and turn back just a few pages to Deuteronomy 27. Deuteronomy 27. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 15. Cursed is the one who makes, here's the words, a carved or molded image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and sets it up in secret. That sounds just exactly like what Micah's mother did. So she seeks to worship the true and living God by directly disobeying the second commandment. Let's continue with our reading in verse 5. The man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So Micah really got into this whole gig. He added even more tinker toys to the setup. He made a shrine for this idol. He also made an ephod, which was something that a priest wore and by which that priest could inquire of the Lord. He also made household idols or household gods, which were kind of like portable idols. And then he consecrated his own priest. So here Micah follows his mother, and in direct contradiction to the law of Moses, that makes clear that only the descendants of Aaron can serve as a priest to Yahweh, he takes his own son and consecrates him as a priest. The law of Moses also indicated that you could worship Yahweh only at the central location that God chooses, which at this point was in Shiloh. But remember, Micah is picking and choosing from the spiritual smorgasbord, and he can have whatever he wants. Let's continue with verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So here we come to the crux of the matter. While the author does not use God's name in these chapters, he does reveal God's point of view by means of this comment here in verse 6, which is repeated at the beginning of chapter 18. So let's park here a moment. So the author believes that the antidote to this kind of smorgasbord spirituality is the authority of a king. Now, we must understand him to mean the right kind of king. Certainly kings like Ahab and Manasseh would not have controlled this kind of thing. They would have encouraged it. The kind of king that the author has in mind is a king like David, a man after God's own heart. When the right kind of spiritual authority is in place, then this kind of smorgasbord spirituality will stop. Now today, that authority comes down from God, not through the state. Remember, in the Old Testament, Israel was a theocracy. And so the king was the authority to stop this kind of false religion. But today, God gives this authority to the church. It's the duty of the pastors, the elders, to stifle this kind of smorgasbord spirituality. By our teaching, by our example, we must lead the members of the local church not to pick and choose what they like from scriptures, but rather to bow the knee to all that God has said. We must not reject what the Bible has to say about hell or homosexuality or gender or abortion or anything else just because our culture puts pressure on us. Smorgasbord spirituality is wrong, and God has put the local church in place for this purpose, a church that will not address this tendency in our culture is refusing to execute its God-given authority, and it's like a King Manasseh, it's like a King Ahab. Do you know why we worship before preaching normally? We worship when we bow the knee. That's what the word means. It means to bow the knee. And so we bow the knee to God before we hear His Word. Because the idea is that we are here in an attitude of submission to whatever God tells us. We're not here to pick and choose from the spiritual smorgasbord. We're here to say, "Yes, Lord, I hear and I will obey." And then notice the second part of verse 6. These people, Micah and his mother, and later in chapter 18, the tribe of Dan, these Israelites were not doing what they considered to be wrong. Verse 6 says, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And it's no different in our day. We live in a postmodern culture in which most people believe there is no absolute truth, particularly in the area of religion. The watchword today goes like, well, that's right for you, but here's what's right for me. You get to choose what you want from the spiritual smorgasbord, but I like this and that, and I don't like that and that. And that's why this story is so applicable to our day, to our culture. Oprah doesn't believe that she is leading astray the millions of people who listen to her. She strongly believes that she is right. As I suggested to you in my introduction, there's no wrong thing to pick or not pick from a smorgasbord. Whatever you like is right for you. No questions asked. And that is the mentality in our culture today, particularly in the realm of religion. Well, let's continue our story, verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. Now, I don't want to take much time with this, but why was a Levite living in Bethlehem? Bethlehem was not a Levitical city. Levites were assigned specific cities in which way they were to live and reside so that they could serve God in the tabernacle. So here's a Levite. He's been appointed by God to serve in the tabernacle, but that's not what he's doing. He's out trying to find a living wherever he could find it. And I get the idea that he was looking for an easy living. Again, we don't really have time to discuss this point in detail. Maybe we can do that this afternoon. Verse 8. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. The Levite finds what he's looking for. Religion is going to furnish him with a cushy job after all. Now, we need to realize that the New Testament consistently links a desire for money with false religion and false teachers. Let me read you a couple of texts. Here's a description of false teachers from Jude 11. "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." We find a similar passage in 2 Peter 2 and verse 15. "They have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness." There will always be those who are willing to stalk the spiritual smorgasbord if it will furnish them with a good living. Both Paul and Peter warn pastors and elders against the profit motive, because that motivation often leads to what we see here in Judges 17. Giving people what they want to hear, tickling their ears, instead of faithfully proclaiming the whole counsel of God. Continuing in verse 11. "Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, 'This is great. Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest.'" Those who sidle up to the spiritual smorgasbord assume that they're right. And everywhere they look, they see evidence of God blessing them. I mean, isn't it obvious that God is blessing Micah's religious enterprise? He's brought to him a Levite to be his priest. Doesn't make any difference that the Levite is not a descendant of Aaron and he's not qualified to be a priest according to the law. He's a Levite! Close enough! Everywhere I look, God's just blessing me. That's Micah's attitude. It's the attitude of a lot of people that enjoy the spiritual smorgasbord. They assume that God blesses their very individualized religion, even though they reject what they will from God's revelation and they refuse to obey God's law. Everywhere they turn, they expect to see God blessing them. They are indeed the sons and daughters of Micah. Here in Judges chapter 17. Now, it seems like the story is complete at this point, at the end of chapter 17, and indeed, we could end the story at this point, but there's much more in chapter 18. So let's continue to read the rest of the story, beginning in Judges 18 and verse 1. The author reminds us, in those days there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites, the tribe of Dan, was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Now again, it seems like the author here is simply reporting the facts. Just the facts, man. Just the facts. Like a reporter from the Jerusalem Herald, Dateline 2000 BC. But I think there's a smirk on his face as he reports these facts. He says, the Danites were seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in, for until that day their inheritance had not fallen to them. Was that true? What book comes before Judges? This is a deep theological truth that I want you to get. You know. What book becomes before the book of Judges? Another J word. Joshua. What's Joshua about? What is the book of Joshua about? It's about the inheritance. It's about the fact that every tribe was given an inheritance. And it was about how some tribes trusted in God and drove the Canaanites out of their inheritance, and some did not. And the reason that the Danites were still seeking an inheritance was because they had failed to drive the Philistines and the Amorites out of the land that God had given them. And they were squeezed into those two little cities that are named there in verse 2, Zorah and Eshtoel. They did not have the faith to go into battle with their Canaanite neighbors and take the land that God had promised them. They were looking for an easier path. I want you to get this. What that Levite was on the individual level, the Danites were as a tribe. Looking for an easier path. And we'll see that easier path led them right to this spiritual smorgasbord. Verse 2. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, go, search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. while they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Now, we don't really know why they recognized his voice. They don't know. You know, he lived originally in Bethlehem, and Bethlehem was close to these two cities. It could be that they actually knew him, but I think it was more likely that they recognized his accent. That's the idea. They both were from southern Israel, if you will. Shalom, y'all. Verse 3 continues, they turned aside and said to him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here?" He said to them, "Thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I've become his priest." So they said to him, "Please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous." Notice here they fall right in with this syncretistic religion of Micah and the Levite. They sidle right up to the spiritual smorgasbord. And the priest said to them, "Go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way." And why wouldn't they fall in with this new form of worshiping Yahweh? It gave them just exactly the answer they were looking for. Now, we need to pause here and let me say something very important. Why do so many people fall into this kind of smorgasbord spirituality? Here's why. Because it gives them the answers that they want to hear. Can I live any way I want to and still go to heaven when I die? Go in peace. The Lord be with you. Can I live a homosexual lifestyle and be a Christian? Go in peace. God made you that way. It's one of the great things about a belief buffet. I can pick just the beliefs that will yield the answers that I'm after. The question is, do you want the power of God? Or do you want the answers that you want to hear? Can't have both. Let's continue reading in verse 7. So the five men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the matter of the Zidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Zidonians and they had no ties with anyone. Then the spies came back to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtoel, and their brethren said to them, "What is your report?" And I love this. This is great. So they said, "Arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. When you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land. For God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth." Do you see the irony here? Do you remember the story from Numbers 13 and 14? You remember that story? You remember when Moses sent the 12 spies into the land? And the 10 came back and they gave the majority report and they said, "Whatever you do, don't go into that land. There's giants in that land. We felt like grasshoppers in their sight." They gave a bad report. They discouraged the people. And here are these five who have sidled up to the spiritual smorgasbord, and they go look at the land, and I mean, they just sound like men of faith, don't they? "God has given it into your hands. Go in and possess the land." I hope you can see the author in the background just shaking his head. Continuing in verse 11, "And 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtoel, and armed with weapons of war. Then they went up and encamped at Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore they call that place Mahanadan to this day, that is west of Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land, or out the country of Laish, answered and said to their brethren, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore, consider what you should do." I like the way the New International Version translates their comments. "Do you know one of these houses has an ephod, other household guards, a carved image, and a cast idol? Now you know what you need to do." So they turned aside and came to the house of the young Levite, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. I hope you're seeing this in cinemascope. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" So the priest's heart was glad. The Lord is really blessing my ministry now, man. And he took the ephod and the household idols and the carved image and took his place among the people. So here it is. What started with one man has now affected an entire tribe. Maybe I should say infected an entire tribe. And there are Bible scholars who think that what happened this day, as Micah's personalized religion spread to the entire tribe of Dan, there are Bible scholars who think that this is what eventually influenced Jeroboam. Now, who was Jeroboam? You remember the story. Jeroboam was the man who took the northern 10 tribes of Israel and tore them away from the southern 2 tribes, from Judah. And one of the key methods for doing that successfully was to create his own religion. He sidled up to the spiritual smorgasbord, chose what he wanted, and started a religion of his own so that those northern 10 tribes didn't need to go any longer to Jerusalem. And eventually, it was that religion that Jeroboam started that ended up in the captivity of Israel. Now we're getting down to it here. Smorgasbord spirituality looks like it gives us exactly what we want. I get to pick and choose what I want to believe. I can look at myself as a genuine believer. I'm a Christian. I can have the heartfelt feeling that God is going to bless me. But the long-term consequences can be devastating. And I want you to get this point. Oftentimes, it's only in the long term, only in the long term, that those consequences are felt. consequences in the lives of those that we influence, consequences in eternity. We do reap what we sow. And the law of sowing and reaping says we reap more than we sow, and we reap later than we sow. And so when we pick and choose our religion from the spiritual smorgasbord, there are consequences, but we may not feel them for years or decades or until we face God Himself in eternity. Continuing in verse 21. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. When they were a good way away from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So Micah said, "You have taken away my gods which I made and the priest, and you have gone away. Now what more do I have? How can you say what ails you?" Now, folks, if you aren't rolling on the ground laughing at this point, you do not have a sense of humor. Micah says, "How can you steal my God, the God that I made? How can you steal my God?" I want you to think about that. What kind of God can be made? What kind of God can be stolen? These be no gods at all. In the final analysis, this is what smorgasbord spirituality is. If I can pick and choose my God, then such a God is no God at all. Such a God bows to us and our desires rather than our desires bowing to Him and to His law. So let's finish the chapter. Verse 25. And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life and the lives of your household." Then the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. So they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer because it was far from Zidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rohab. So they rebuilt the city and dwelt there, and they called the name of that city Dan, after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. Long-term consequences. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. So here's the epilogue. The Danites ended up with a God who can be made and a priest who can be bought and a city that was not defended. What a tribe. Let's all sing "Onward, Danite Soldiers." I want you to notice verse 30, because verse 30 is the legacy of the tribe of Dan. They set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. I want you to notice that their legacy is tied to the captivity. It seems like the author does not want us to miss that long-term consequence of what started with one man and his mother, Micah, and ended up in the captivity of an entire nation. Now, the author, in his very subtle way, has illustrated a truth that has always intrigued me from Psalm 115. So I want you to turn over finally to Psalm 115. Psalm 115, beginning in verse 4. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Noses they have, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk. Nor do they mutter through their throat. Those who make them are like them. So is everyone who trusts in them. Those who make them are like them. We become like the gods we make, whether we make them with our hands or whether we make them with our hearts. The Danites took to themselves gods that had no power, and they ended up a tribe that had no power. A tribe that could only find an inheritance by finding an undefended city. Those who sidle up to the spiritual smorgasbord should be very, very careful, for they will be like the gods they construct for themselves. Now, as I close, let me weave the threads together that run through this story. We live in a day much like those of the judges, a day in which everyone does what's right in his own eyes, a day in which there is very little spiritual authority. This story is as up to date as the latest tweet to go viral. Those who pick and choose what they want to believe and practice from Scripture assume that God is blessing them even as they do that which directly contradicts His revelation, His Word, and His law. And in the end, the consequences of eating at the spiritual smorgasbord will be seen in the emptiness of a life in spiritual bondage and ultimately in eternal destruction. Now, I need to say one final thing. It's real easy for us as Bible-believing Christians to think that this is something that only happens out there. It only happens to people that tune into Oprah. No, my friends. Bible-believing Christians can sidle up to the spiritual smorgasbord as well. It's real easy for us to pick and choose. We pat ourselves on the back and go, I'm a Bible-believing Christian. I believe the whole Bible, cover to cover. I even believe the covers. But it's real easy for us to leave things on the buffet and refuse to put them on the plate when we find them in God's Word, isn't it? it's easy for us to create idols, false images of the true God in our hearts. Caricatures. Let me ask you, are you worshiping a caricature of the true and living God? Or have you let Him speak for Himself and be who He is according to His Word? Do you see what I'm saying? So what I would challenge you as we close this morning to pray a simple prayer. Lord, show me where I'm picking and choosing rather than submitting to Your Word. Would you pray that prayer as we close this morning? Don't pray it if you don't mean it. You might be surprised how God will answer this prayer. Would you pray that prayer as we close this morning? Lord, show me where I'm picking and choosing rather than submitting to Your Word. Let's close our eyes. Let's bow our heads. It's going to take a few moments. Would you pray that prayer in all sincerity and open yourself up to the leading of God, the work of His Holy Spirit, and bringing you to a place of true submission?